I'm now speaking with Azeeq Haque, who is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He previously litigated national security cases at the Brennan Center for Justice and clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and was a senior consultant analyst for the International Crisis Group, and has since worked as an analyst in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nepal. He's the co-author of the book Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Azeeq, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us. And today, clearly, the president, in an interview that he recorded for Sunday's broadcast with 60 Minutes, said that he had decided not to release these pictures of an apparently deceased Osama bin Laden. That the White House press secretary said were gruesome, and apparently the president felt that it was nothing to be gained from further inflaming the Islamic world. And I imagine he's prepared to live with the consequences of conspiracy theories. My understanding, though, is that for example, in Pakistan and in a lot of Islamic countries, first of all, up to a majority of the people don't even believe that bin Laden was involved with 9/11 in the first place. So I guess that's a situation you can't win, right? Because already the Pakistan press is saying that they don't believe that bin Laden was in their country and that this person that was supposed to be shot was him.
That's correct. The purpose of releasing the photos off the dead body would be to squash rumors or conspiracy theories that bin Laden was still alive. The problem with trying to achieve that goal by the release of the photos is it's not clear that the photos by themselves would change anybody's mind. If there is someone out there who is inclined to believe in a conspiracy, it's hard to see why a photo, which surely they would believe could be doctored, would alter their perspective on that.
So what do you make, though, of the revival of torture as a virtue in our political debate? One would have thought that after Abu Ghraib and the waterboarding of KSM and the general hit that the United States has taken around the world in terms of its reputation and the extent to which now all of the dictators, as we see Gaddafi and the Syrian dictator and Mugabe and down in Zimbabwe, they're all free to say, well, you know, when they're criticized for torturing their people, which they do on a regular basis, they can always say, well, the Americans do it too. And here we have suddenly a bunch of senior Republicans mostly saying that, oh, the reason we got caught bin Laden was because we used torture. I mean, there's no factual basis for this, but what do you make of this revival of this absurdity?
I think that there's a couple of things to emphasize about this or to say about this. The first is basically what you said at the end, that the argument that it was an enhanced interrogation tactic that yielded the information that was necessary to bin Laden's identification and eventual killing is unfounded. That was an allegation that was made by Peter King on Sunday night, an hour, after the announcement itself had been made by the president.
Well, now, by the way, let me just let for the benefit of the audience point out that Peter King is the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee.
Right. He's somebody who has responsibilities for national security by dint of the committee system. The argument has evolved since Sunday night into the claim that, well, we don't know whether it was enhanced interrogation tactics that yielded this outcome that people, I think, generally rightly think it's a good outcome, notwithstanding what, you know, some people in Pakistan might think. Because we don't know that it was, because we can't rule out that it was enhanced interrogation tactics, we ought to endorse those tactics just in case they work. Well, that's just a non sequitur. Nothing about the circumstances of this arrest or attempted arrest and interdiction suggests that it was enhanced interrogation tactics that either increased or allowed for the interdiction to happen. It's simply, I think, better understood as a piece of political posturing. The Republican Party has always been a party that has polled better on security. In order to maintain that position, what you have to do is outflank your Democratic opponents. Outflanking the Democrats became much harder on Sunday night because President Obama had a palpable victory on the national security front that President Bush didn't have for 7 years, an embarrassing fact. And I think that there is a certain scrambling to make up for that political loss.
So this is a sort of, Aziz Huck, is this a sort of Karl Rovian tactic that you take away the other guy's greatest virtue? John Kerry was a war hero, so let's...
Well, I don't think that's a Karl Rove tactic. I think that's a politician's tactic.
Yeah.
Clinton did it in the 90s. Karl Rove did it in, or Bush did it in 2000. I think it's a... I don't think that there's anything...
knew
unusual about it. I just think that this is what politicians do, and I actually think that one is, you know, to think that politicians will stop doing this if one criticizes them for being inaccurate or hypocrites, I think is unrealistic. This is just what you would expect to see in political debate.
Well, the fact that, for example, Sarah Palin has praised George W. Bush for being responsible for getting bin Laden without mentioning...
One thing that I think that I haven't seen picked up on yet, but I'm sure will be, is that people forget that the intelligence concerning the alleged connections between al-Qaeda and the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq also came from al-Libi. Al-Libi is the detainee who provided the name The Courier, who was eventually identified and then followed back to the Abbasabad compound. So there's something much more ambiguous, I think, than either side of the political debate is willing to recognize going on here, right? That this was a person who provided information that, in some instances, led to a victory in counterterrorism efforts, but in other respects led or enabled what many people think was a catastrophic misallocation of resources in a way that prolonged, deepened, and perhaps even made worse the same conflict.
Well, but didn't al-Libi, after he'd fed all this information, suggest that he was dissembling, that was a part of his strategy?
He did renege. Unfortunately, yeah. It is impossible to ask al-Libi what happened after he was detained by American agencies and then the military. He was handed over to the Libyan government. This is back when we were friends with the Gaddafi regime. And during the course of his detention by the Libyan government, died.
Right.
So we will not be able, unfortunately, to confirm either one way or the other the details of how this information was managed by the person who initially supplied it.
Well, what we can say is that if it was a strategy on al-Libi's part to feed this bogus information to President Bush and Vice President Cheney that linked Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda and therefore became the fig leaf for the intervention, the disastrous intervention in Iraq, then the proof's in the pudding, right? It was the worst.
I think it's hard. It's hard to know what his motives were.
Right, but I'm saying that. But the long and the short of it is, history. The historical record is such that you could actually make that case that it was for Al Qaeda. It was a great coup to get them to get Bush to get into Iraq.
There is, I think, a very cogent argument that the decision to go into Iraq was much more important in terms of the trajectory of the of the war or the conflict against Al Qaeda than the decision or the fact of having identified and run bin Laden himself to ground. Right? This is an organization, I think, that even in 03 and 04 was making a transition, Al Qaeda here, from a relatively centralized entity to something that was diffuse and dispersed. It's an ideology with franchises. And under those circumstances, while it is true that bin Laden has and had an important symbolic role, while it's true that his continued evasion of the United States, I think, symbolized something about the relative power of the United States, while it is true that he played something of a directive role, all of those things were becoming less true over time. And it was becoming more and more important that he had launched into the world an idea, an ideology, and a possibility, a set of arguments. I and most people think wrong arguments for the slaughter of civilians that others had accepted. And his death does not end the availability of those ideas freely on the internet, freely in publications, in circulation around the world, ideas that are going to be attractive under some circumstances to some group of people.
Well, just in closing, Aziz Haq, since you wrote the book Unchecked and Unbalanced Presidential Powers in a Time of Terror, without beating a dead horse here, it is a bit amazing that there is no honeymoon for the president in terms of this achievement on the national security front. He's already, Glenn Beck has already said that Osama bin Laden apparently was shot without being armed, that the president will go and kill anybody. So it's pretty amazing what's being said now in terms of the idea that this fellow is a rogue agent who's running around murdering people. Congressman King even suggested he might go after, he could kill Bradley Manning for all that matter. But what's your sense, though, in terms of the post-mortem that's likely to happen vis-a-vis U.S.-Pakistani relations? Do you think will there be any clarity there?
I very much doubt that this event will in itself induce any kind of clarity about America's relations with Pakistan. America's relationships with Pakistan are extraordinarily complex. They are a function of the complexity is in large part a function of the fact that people talk about Pakistan as if it were a singular entity when it is really not. It is an incredibly fractured and fragmented, not just society, but state. The state has factions that are deeply, deeply ideologically committed against the United States. The state has factions that are sympathetic to the United States. And when we try and aid Pakistan militarily, diplomatically, through development aid, it is always unclear how the interaction of those domestic factions in Pakistan will play out and who our aid will help. And no American administration, either Republican or Democrat, has comfortably found a way to deal with that fact. And I'm not aware of any plausible strategy that has been put forward either by part of the government or even by a think tank to deal with that. So I think that Pakistan will remain a problem. It's a nuclear power. It's a place where there's a substantial pool of people who would like to commit acts of terrorism. It's a country at a strategic crossroads beside India and Pakistan and China and Afghanistan. It is not a country that will vanish from the American strategic radar, and it is not a country that we have any hope, I think, in the near term of dealing with in some sort of rational, stable way.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Aziz Haq.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who's professor at the University of Chicago Law School, previously litigated national security cases at the Brennan Center for Justice. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of the book Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror.